Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Confirmed cases of COVID-19 have been appearing in eastern Kentucky, where there is less health infrastructure to handle a spike. And we're interested in how the virus is making its presence known outside of major urban areas of Kentucky and the impact of responding to the COVID-19 pandemic in rural Appalachia. Joining us to talk about it is someone who is very much in the center of Appalachian Kentucky healthcare, Dr. Maria Brayman, Vice President, Medical Affairs and Chief Medical Officer at Appalachian Regional Healthcare in Hazard. Greetings, Dr. Brayman. First, some information on Appalachian Regional Healthcare, if you would. How many hospitals, how many clinics in the ARH universe?
Appalachian Regional Healthcare is a 13-hospital healthcare system in eastern Kentucky and southern West Virginia. We also have just under 80 clinics throughout, as I said, eastern Kentucky and southern West Virginia, as well as home health care stores, retail pharmacies, and home health agencies as well.
Okay. Concerning the coronavirus and COVID-19, if you could just tell us generally what you are seeing, and then we'll get into some specifics.
We, like much of the rest of the country, have seen recently a relative increase in the number of cases compared to where we were a few months ago. In rural parts of the country, when places like New York and Washington State were spiking, we were relatively untouched at that time. That doesn't mean completely untouched, but really we weren't seeing that kind of influx. We still are not seeing anything on the magnitude of New York City, and that's based on population density for sure. But we are starting to see an increased number of cases in many of our communities, and specifically our nursing homes are at increased risk. And we're finding in some of our communities, our nursing homes are getting quite overrun with COVID-19.
Are your hospitals prepared to handle an increase in cases?
I would have told you, if you asked me this question back in March when we were first all being confronted with this, that we were not prepared. But we quickly went to work in order to prepare for a spike and rise in cases. So today I can tell you that now there is certainly more availability of personal protective equipment, which is needed by healthcare workers. We have increased availability of testing as well. And ARH as a healthcare system is uniquely positioned so that we can shift our resources to areas where there might be a spike in one of our communities. What we've seen with this virus is it doesn't surge in all areas at the same time. It tends to surge in a location or a community. So we do have the ability to respond to that.
Had there been a reduction in elective surgeries? And if so, I wonder how that has impacted your revenues, your operations and staffing.
Early on, when there was a significant lack of access to personal protective equipment for healthcare providers, and there was significant lack of access to testing, we did shut down all of our elective procedures, as well as many of our non-urgent and non-emergent outpatient visits. And that had a significant impact on revenue. Now, we did open back up starting in May for elective procedures. We've opened our clinics back up. And I can tell you that there was a lot of pent-up need because people hadn't been able to get in and see their providers. And we are today back up to the same number of procedures and clinic visits as we were prior to going into that lockdown. So we're recapturing the revenue. We had furloughed close to 800 staff members, and most of those people we've been able to bring back on.
How would you say that Eastern Kentucky's experience with the virus compares with what you're seeing in your West Virginia hospitals?
West Virginia has lagged a little bit behind Kentucky. They have had significantly less number of cases than the state of Kentucky has. So West Virginia has not been as impacted by the virus overall as the state of Kentucky has.
On the matter of testing for COVID-19, if you test negative one day, isn't it possible that you could, in the next day or so, become exposed and infected? Should we be taking tests frequently?
So this is true, and the issue of testing can be a really complex one to answer. And the answer is yes. When you're tested, the result you get for that day, if you're tested by the viral PCR test, which is testing you for the presence of the virus, then all that's telling you is that on that day, whether or not you have enough virus in your body to turn that test positive. So there's two answers to that question. One, you could be infected and still test negative if it's very early on in you being infected because your body just hasn't produced enough virus yet for the test to be able to turn positive. So that would be one reason. And then the other reason is that you're exactly correct. You could be tested today and then tomorrow be exposed and get the virus. So testing for the presence of the virus on one day is only giving you a snapshot into that moment of time. Now, there are different types of tests. There's also an antibody test. The antibody test is not testing the presence of virus itself. It's testing your body's response to having been exposed to the virus. So an antibody test gives you a little bit more information about history. For example, if your test is positive for a type of antibody called IgG, that tells you that you had been exposed to the virus in the past. It would have to be at a minimum of 2 weeks or more previously. So that's what IgG would tell you. And then there's another kind of antibody regularly being tested for called IgM antibody. That becomes positive a little bit more quickly and will tell you usually within 2 to 3 days of exposure, your body generates an IgM response. And that will tell you that you're more recently exposed.
Interesting. So you are in Hazard, and I'm just wondering, Dr. Brayman, when you're out and about, do you notice that people in your area are taking preventive measures, wearing masks and social distancing and those sorts of things?
You know, Tom, it's really disappointing. Here we are, and it's July, and I really think that people have become more frustrated by the fact that they've been isolated for so long, and they've really started to forget that this virus is still present. In April, when there was more heightened focus on COVID-19, I saw more people in our community masking and social distancing. But now I think that people are tired and they're not taking the same precautions that they were. And we are seeing the results of that in increased numbers of positive COVID-19 patients.
It's almost as though just as people are growing weary of it, we're seeing it spike.
Well, absolutely. And it makes sense because the virus has not left us.
Right.
The virus is no less virulent or less present today than it was back in March and April.
Well, contact tracing is becoming an imperative. And even so, many see it as this invasive thing, and they worry about the implications for personal privacy as well as that of their friends, family, and others. How is that being received in your area?
Fortunately, we are generally getting a good response when we reach out to people to try and determine if there's been an exposure in any of our hospitals or by one of our staff members. They've been really willing to give us the information. Now, the population that we deal with in contact tracing as a healthcare provider is really our staff, right? So anyone else for the contact tracing is handled by the health department. So I think our healthcare workers are acutely aware of the importance of being truthful, of being open and available and sharing all contacts because they've been educated of how important that is in order to help us reduce the spread of the virus.
You know, going back to the question of masking up, of wearing the mask, there are health factors like compromised immune system, pulmonary diseases, black lung, diabetes, issues with obesity, heart disease, cancer. All of these are health disparities that rural places like Eastern Kentucky experience in higher rates than national averages. Shouldn't that information alone be enough to persuade people to wear those masks?
Well, you'd really hope so. We're finding, and not just here in rural Kentucky, but, you know, around the globe, and certainly in the United States, we are finding that there's not a consistent message that's being delivered from all of our leaders that says that you must mask in order to protect not only yourselves, but one another. And not everyone is willing to do that. It's become, unfortunately, highly politicized. This is not a political issue. Masking is directly related to keeping yourself safe and preventing the spread of this disease. Masking helps our economy grow because we can live as safely as possible, not with no risk. But we can minimize risk of this disease and spread if everyone were to universally mask. But unfortunately, the message there has become so convoluted in our society that we're just not all willing to do that right now.
Is this pandemic experience highlighting the need for more hospital capacity in Eastern Kentucky? Do you have what you need?
You know, I actually think that our current capacity in terms of hospital and beds and ventilators, really, we have the capacity to care for our patients in that regard. The bigger issue for us, quite frankly, is the capacity of nursing staff, right? We're already experiencing a nursing shortage when the pandemic hit. And that's not only here in Eastern Kentucky, but that's manifested across the United States. And so with that nursing shortage, that means we have difficulty in staffing capacity. So if we were to have a significant surge, our bigger concerns are related to staffing and not related to equipment and beds and structural abilities. We have those.
Dr. Maria Brayman, Vice President, Medical Affairs and Chief Medical Officer at Appalachian Regional Healthcare in Hazard. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
After hearing from colleagues and friends about the furloughs and layoffs where they work, it became clear that this is a tough time to be a human resources manager. Not only do HR managers have to be concerned about employees' health and well-being during the pandemic, they're also under the strain of processing paperwork and providing solace to workers who've been laid off or furloughed. Lyle Hanna, president and CEO of Hanna Resource Group, advises HR managers on the local, national, and international levels. There's even an award in his name, the Lyle Hanna Spirit Award, given by the Kentucky Society of Human Resources Managers. And so we wondered what he's been hearing. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Lyle.
Thank you, Tom. It's a delight to be with you.
So this has to be a very difficult time to manage human resources, working people whose careers and lives have suddenly been upended by the almost overnight downsizing and the closings brought on by this pandemic. And I think I'm correct that you hold a weekly briefing with HR managers. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. We 14 weeks last Monday, every Monday for going back more than 3 months.
Spanning this whole thing then.
Right. We got started early and had an opportunity. An attorney we work with had a case. As the law was being passed, a serious, serious case that disrupted a large manufacturer's employment process, you know, all the work they were doing. And boy, we thought we could learn a lot from this. Everybody needs a crisis management plan, and no one had one. So we started talking to people on Monday mornings, and that has carried on to this day.
Can you give us some highlights of what you're hearing from HR folks over this 14-week period?
Boy, I sure can. it has changed a lot. At first, it was, what is this? How do we deal with this? What are the regulations? And the regulations, Tom, were changing overnight. In fact, we were meeting on Mondays because we thought, oh, we'll have the weekend to prepare. But it turned out the laws were changing over the weekend. So if you prepared something on Friday, you had to re-prepare it on Sunday night because things are changing that quickly.
Is it in the training for HR folks to learn how to protect themselves from becoming emotionally drained by decisions and by all those changes that you just told us about?
Well, that's a great issue, and not everybody thinks about that. But, you know, HR managers are trained to try to build the best place to work and help create a great environment for everyone, including for their own ability to work. But this is the first time in my long career that we've had such a challenge across the board for all employers, all HR managers, having to deal with this. You know, what kind of pressure, what kind of impact is this having on our employees? That's something that every HR manager has now become totally aware of, that they not only have to keep their own mental acuity high and positive, but they've got to work on that for the whole workforce.
So, Lyle, what other surprises are in store for HR managers?
Well, I'll tell you one that surprises people, Tom, is that when an employee is working at home, they're still covered by workers' compensation. So if they get carpal tunnel syndrome because they're working at the dining room table instead of the nice desk you have at work that's the right height, that falls under workers' comp. So employers have some risk here that they never dreamed of by having employees work at home.
Well, I know that there are some organizations in our area here that have had to lay off a lot of people.
Yes.
Or furlough a lot of people, or both. And I'm just wondering, do you hear from the HR professionals you talk with that they're struggling to stay dispassionate and focused?
Well, they're struggling to keep up. There's a lot of extra work now with people working from home. You know, there are some differences in how you manage your people. And HR people have to figure out what that is and how you help keep people at work, keep them working and keep them not working. Because some funny things happened, Tom, when everybody started working from home. We had a lot of clients who never wanted to do that. They didn't really want people to have the freedom to work from home, so they didn't allow it. And now they were forced to allow it. And guess what? They actually got better work out of people a lot of times. They were getting projects done early on that they had tried to get done for 2 and 3 years, and suddenly people had time to do them. There are pros and cons about the whole thing, but it's been an adventure and a challenge just to keep up with how things really have developed throughout this pandemic.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think it's just beginning to dawn on a lot of us who are in that situation where we're working from home now, that, well, for example, we don't have to deal with people darkening our office door so many times during the day and interrupting what we're doing.
Right. No congregation at the coffee machine either. There's no wasted time because nobody's around to talk to you except your pup and your family. So all that has changed, but HR managers are adjusting to that and adapting to it. And, you know, one of the things we're finding is if there's nobody around to interrupt you, it's hard to know when you stop. So people at home were actually working longer, harder, you know, more intensely sometimes than they would at work. And that accounts for the extra work they got done, but it also becomes a real pressure cooker.
So does that open up a new concern for HR professionals to be thinking about counseling or coaching remote workers not to go too far with that productivity, to think about themselves a little bit?
Yeah, and we want them to be productive. It's a balance, you know, Tom. But we also don't want them to burn out. And so actually HR managers are digging deep down in their pockets to find other special ways to do that. So we're actually doing special training, and we're doing coaching of individual people and helping, you know, some people handle this better than others do. And, you know, for some people, their jobs have never gone away. But all the support they had from, you know, like they're required to be there so that the work goes on. But you think of the city of Lexington, oh, so many of their employees still have to be there. You still have to pick up the trash and maintain the streets and keep the stoplights working and so many things that they do, you know. But there aren't as many people around to support those people now. So that's put a lot of pressure on folks. many employers have an EAP, Employee Assistance Program. Those are nice benefits, rarely used, but now they are becoming greatly used because employee assistance programs, actually many of them have a series of counseling. You can get 2 or 3 or 4 hours of counseling in those programs. And honestly, they haven't been used much in the past, but people are starting to pull them off the shelf and say, wait a minute, we've got this. Let's use this to help our employees.
No, that's really interesting. And if you just joined us, we're talking with Lyle Hanna. He's the president and CEO of Hanna Resource Group in Lexington. And Lyle, I'd like to get your thoughts about a quote that I read from one HR manager.
Mm-hmm.
It goes like this. What has changed the most for HR professionals and the role that they will be playing moving forward is that in our world, the focus tended to be on pay. Now, I believe health and wellness benefits are going to be the game changer. Do you agree with that?
Well, there's a lot of truth in that statement. Pay always has been a driving factor, and a lot of people didn't pay that much attention to their benefit plans. Oh, I've got a medical plan, and then, you know, that's it. But boy, oh boy, now those things have become a lot more important. And part of it is this, Tom. We're worried about our own health and the health of our families. And now, suddenly, when it's challenged, I mean, it's funny, this little disease is insidious as can be. And I know people that are positive on their tests, and they have no idea how they got it. They thought they were being so careful and not exposing themselves to any risk. And then they went in for a test just because they thought, well, I ought to have one just in case. And boom, they found out they were positive. They cannot trace it. They don't know where how it could possibly be. And they're not alone. Other people find that. So it's just a scary thing. So I would say that health and wellness is really important, but I might expand that to say the whole remote workforce is a huge, huge challenge, but keeping them safe and getting them back to work, oh my gosh, that's a challenge because people are still afraid to come back and be in groups, you know, in tight situations and so forth. So the employer has to figure out, how do I set up work? How many do I bring back at one time? Can I space them out in the workplace? What can I do to get them so that they feel like they're safe at work? That is a big issue.
Gosh, this is a whole new level of herding cats, isn't it?
Oh, my. Yes, it is. Because we don't even know where the cats are going to go.
Well, Lyle, do you happen to have a crystal ball? Have any thoughts on what HR is going to look like once this pandemic is finally in our rearview mirror?
Oh, boy. Well, I can tell you this. I don't have a crystal ball entirely, but we have to take being safe seriously. We have to wear masks. There are a lot of people that are fighting that, arguing, don't make me wear a mask. Well, the mask makes you 5 times less likely to get this disease. That's a big deal. And we've got to do that. And in the workplace, employers have got to require that. And I think that employers that don't are going to lose business. The employees are going to be afraid to come back to work. We've seen a survey, an employer that we're associated with, did a survey of their employees. Most of them are home. It's time to bring them back. They've just done phase 1 of the return in Kentucky. So they've done that. Now they're looking at the next phases. And you know what? A huge percentage, 54% said, no, thank you. I am not ready to come back. It's not safe to come back. They like working from home and they feel safer working from home. About 36% said, we don't want to come back until there is a vaccine. Oh my gosh, you know, that's a long ways off probably. Mm-hmm. I think at best guess it's first year. I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, you can imagine if people are holding out for that, that's going to be a long time to be able to get them back. So we've got to come up with ways to make our employees feel safe and comfortable.
So much uncertainty, and it's going to be this way for a while. I'd like to check back with you in a few months, if I might, Lyle, and see where we stand at that point.
Oh, please do. I'll be glad to, you know, I think a lot's going to change over time, but I think we got to stay vigilant at helping people learn better ways to be safe, help teaching people how to be safe, give them the tools. I have a friend that has a company that makes plexiglass, things out of plexiglass.
Oh, boy.
He can't even go home at night. He's making so many of those dividers and so forth. So some businesses are going crazy, you know, busy right now. Other ones are cutting back. Tom, we've got one other thing we're trying to do. We did those 14 sessions just because we thought it would be helpful. And we're getting ready to do something else, and that is helping people learn, how do you find a new job during a pandemic. And we're just volunteering. I've got people that help people find jobs every day. And I said, like, go put together a program, and it's going to be 5 steps, a Zoom conference open to anybody that wants to be there. I don't know how it'll come out, but I know these guys know what they're doing, and they'll be able to give people good advice. And we just got to, we have to do that throughout the community to help each other work our way through this pandemic.
Is that Zoom conference going to be accessible by the public, by everybody? Or?
It's open to the public. That's what we're doing. And we're already talking to the Society for Human Resource Management. Their local chapter is helping us with it. Some other groups are going to be helping with it, the UK Job Club, and we'll see what happens. But we've made it wide open. We're just trying to help out.
All right. Lyle Hanna, President, CEO of Hanna Resource Group. Thank you, Lyle. We appreciate it.
You bet, Tom. What a delight to speak with you.
Coming up after the break, lessons from the pandemic of 2020.
The biggest lesson here is that we need increased social services and that the American infrastructure is deeply, deeply flawed.
And Silas House on the reissue of three of his most popular novels and how music plays a role in his work.
It's one way that I get to know my characters. If I know what kind of music they love, then I know the characters.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
You know when life has become truly bizarre, when even writers of science fiction have a hard time keeping up with reality. Pop culture critic and writer Dahlia Schweitzer, who explores depictions of pandemics and outbreak narratives in film and television, is Chris Begley's next guest on our series, Future Tense.
Today, I'm with Dahlia Schweitzer. She's an associate professor in the film and media department at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City. She's the author of a book called Going Viral, Zombies, Viruses, and the End of the World, published in 2018. Welcome, Dahlia, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
In this book, you analyze outbreak narratives that you've seen primarily in film. Could you tell us a little bit about that? And I know you've broken those down into sort of a number of types.
Yes, I attribute the fundamental or the sort of original outbreak narrative to movies like Outbreak and Contagion, which really emphasize the connection between globalization and contagion. And so this idea that the more, you know, interlocked our world is, the more vulnerable we are to disease. The more we travel, the easier it is for the virus to spread, et cetera. But then I also noticed that after 9/11, we start throwing terrorism into the mix. And then you have a lot of these movies and TV shows where the virus is spread intentionally by terrorists with some kind of an ulterior motive. And then the third type of outbreak narrative that I look at in the book is the one that is most prevalent now. And that's, of course, where you get the zombies and you get the apocalypse and you get the end of the world. And so those are sort of the three main types that I talk about in the book.
Can you tell us a little bit about why this interested you? I know that you've written a number of things, analyses of pop culture. You have a recent book about detectives in Los Angeles, for instance.
I don't get asked that very often, surprisingly. But the initial interest in the topic came about, all my books sort of start with questions, you know, like, and I don't even know if there's going to be anything there. I just kind of wonder, is there something there? And I learned about sex at the same time that I learned about AIDS. There was never a period in my life where I knew about one and not the other. And so I was interested in how knowing about AIDS would change the way that we think about intimacy, you know, because prior to AIDS, there was this idea that, you know, sex was warm and nurturing and healing and good and all that stuff. And then there was this real pronounced shift after AIDS that sex was deadly, that intimacy was deadly. And so AIDS really just kind of changed the paradigm, and also the idea that someone that looks perfectly healthy could be sick with the virus that will kill you. And so I was sort of, that was the initial question. And then I started kind of unpacking it a bit. And then I noticed that we have these sort of outbreak narratives with their very repetitive formula. And I was sort of like, well, what's going on there? And then the book unfolded.
One of the really interesting things for me in reading this is your focus on sort of the fear of these outbreaks, but the need for scapegoats, and especially the need for a visible enemy that is something you can target and react to in a way that we're used to, I suppose.
Yes, we love to other. And it just makes it easier to kind of impose this narrative where there's a bad guy, you know, and that's why after 9/11, there was a little bit of confusion because our enemy wasn't a country, right? So it wasn't like, you know, in World War II where the Germans were bad, right? After 9/11, it was like, who's exactly our enemy? Is it Pakistan? Not really. Is it Afghanistan? Not really. And so there was this narrative that was created about Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, and Karl Rove, you know, went to Hollywood to talk to them about how they could make narratives that would really sort of simplify the conflict. And so you had the good guys and the bad guys so that Americans could sort of get on board with all the war messaging, and that they knew that, like, Osama was the bad guy, you know, the Muslims were the terrorists, et cetera. And we have the exact same thing that happens with outbreak narratives. And you can even see it in real life now with COVID and, you know, Trump calling it, you know, the Wuhan flu, Kung flu, you know, the Chinese flu, all that stuff. It's like, if we have a villain, if we have, like, you know, someone we can blame, then it sort of simplifies everything.
Of all these narratives that you've looked at, is there one that seems to you the most accurate, or maybe has played out in real life?
The one that's the most accurate for sure is Steven Soderbergh's Contagion that came out in 2011. And accuracy was very important for him. And he had, you know, lots of consultants who worked with the actors, who worked with the set designers, just so that everything would seem very, very kind of plausible, the way that the virus worked, for instance. So that's definitely the one that is the most closely approximating a real life outbreak.
So now we find ourselves in an actual viral pandemic, an actual outbreak. You know, it's no longer a fictional narrative. How's it played out compared to what you saw in the narratives you analyzed, or maybe what you expected as somebody who's investigated this sort of thing?
Honestly, I had never thought this before the last few months, but Contagion in many ways is a best case scenario. Even when COVID started kind of becoming a thing, people were talking about it, I will freely admit that I was one of those people who was like, oh, you know, no need to panic, we're going to be fine. Because I really, really overestimated the government's preparedness for dealing with this kind of an outbreak. And so, for instance, if you watch a movie like Contagion, it's not even on the radar that, like, oh, the hospitals aren't going to have enough gloves, or, you know, the hospitals aren't going to have enough masks, that you're going to have political parties saying that the virus is a hoax, people refusing to believe that the virus is really happening and kind of protesting that it's all a lie. I mean, like, all that stuff I would never have predicted, and I don't think Hollywood would ever have predicted.
No, it wouldn't have been a very compelling screenplay.
They would have laughed it out of Hollywood. They would have just been like, this is, like, to have a president who says that it's a hoax, to have, you know, FEMA stealing, you know, protective equipment from hospitals and states So you have, like, you know, the state of Maryland has to hide their protective equipment with the National Guard so that the federal government doesn't steal it. I mean, that stuff is just completely off the rails. Like, you would, that no one in Hollywood would even take that seriously. And then that's what we've been living through.
Let's think about the post-pandemic world. At some point, we will be entering a post-pandemic world. And in the narratives you study, some of these pandemics or the outbreaks end up being apocalyptic, and you have the post-apocalyptic sort of zombie stories. But in some others, they don't. Are there any lessons there or something you've picked up that you think might be what we can expect in a post-pandemic situation?
I mean, honestly, I feel like we are in uncharted territory. I read the news and it just never ceases to blow my mind. You know, you read about states who are artificially manipulating their COVID cases in order to make it look like it's safe to reopen when it's not actually safe to reopen. And as I said, you have people who are refusing to wear masks and sort of just comply with basic protocol. You have people who are already saying, you know, that when the vaccine is developed, they refuse to get it. So at this point, I just feel like there's no map. Like, we are just sort of in uncharted territory. And I don't think there's any other country in the world that's dealing with the virus quite like ours.
Well, what do you hope would happen as a result of this? I mean, one of the questions that I've pondered is, can we go back to what we were before? And then, of course, should we go back?
I think the biggest lesson here is that we need increased social services, and that the American infrastructure is deeply, deeply flawed. And I know, like, we can see with the racial protests that are happening right now and the police response to it is alarmingly, it's as if it's easier for us, for our country to kind of rally to get our military out there to keep the protesters in line. And yet we seem to have no idea how to have enough latex gloves distributed to hospitals. You know, we have no idea how to distribute masks for people to wear. You have people getting in trouble for not wearing a mask, but there's no public distribution of the masks. So I think the biggest wake-up call in all this is just how broken our infrastructure is and how much we need to strengthen social services.
And do you think that the reality that's playing out will change the way outbreak narratives are written in the future?
That's actually a really good question, and I'm really intrigued. I know Michael Bay has already, like, signed on. He's working on one. So I'm very curious to see the next crop looks like. And if they incorporate some of these themes about the politicizing of the virus and certain political parties refusing to acknowledge that it's a thing. And I'm very curious to see what kind of happens next, because 6 months ago, I would never have predicted that we would be in this kind of place, you know, where Trump is coming out and accusing the nurses of selling PPE on the black market. And that's why they're actually the shortages. And then you have the people saying that it's all a hoax and the hospitals are actually empty. I mean, it's just, it's so many layers of insanity that I wouldn't even know where to begin kind of predicting what would happen next.
Yeah, it's certainly unpredictable. And, you know, for me, one of the interesting things is looking at these narratives, looking at apocalyptic narratives, are the way in which our reaction to this just was not predicted in any of the previous narratives.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. That was Dahlia Switzer, author of Going Viral, Zombies, Viruses, and the End of the World. Thank you, Dahlia.
Thank you.
It's an honor to welcome Silas House back to Eastern Standard because the occasion is, in fact, auspicious. Since his first book was published, House has become one of the best-known voices in Southern literature. He's also widely known for his activism for the environment, rural people, and LGBTQ issues. Silas executive produced and appeared in the documentary Hillbilly, which was directed by another Kentuckian, Ashley York. His latest offering is Southernmost. Silas's work has often been at the very center of national conversations. You could read them in The Atlantic, Time, Newsday, Garden and Gun, The Oxford American. And he's made frequent appearances in The New York Times. A former commentator for NPR's All Things Considered, House is also one of Nashville's most in-demand press kit writers. He's worked on the publicity campaigns of artists like Jason Isbell, Kris Kristofferson, Lucinda Williams, and Leanne Womack. And now, the reissue of his first three books, Clay's Quilt, A Parchment of Leaves, and The Cole Tattoo. Thanks for joining us, Silas.
Thank you, Tom.
And it must be awfully exciting to see these three works now offered as a trilogy.
Yeah, they've all been in print ever since they were first published, but they've been repackaged in a, you know, they have these beautiful new covers. They all have supplemental material, such as new forewords, author notes. And then one of the things I'm most excited about is that each of the books has a family tree in it. So you can actually refer to the family tree, you know, and read the whole trilogy if you want to and know how everybody's related and all that.
And we're going to get into that connectedness in just a moment because I'm really curious about that. But one thing that did catch my eye is that Clay's Quilt features a foreword by Tyler Childers, who says he was profoundly influenced by the book as a young artist. What does he tell you about why the book resonated with him?
I do know that he has said that it helped him to be more proud of where he was from. You know, and as a young person in Appalachia, the whole world is telling you to be ashamed of where you're from. And so I think that's one of the things I love most about that book is hearing from readers who tell me that it made them proud to be from a rural place, particularly from Eastern Kentucky.
And how did he come to write the foreword?
Well, he had a new album that came out right when we were repackaging the books. And I think it was in The Guardian or some British magazine or newspaper, he mentioned that my work had been an influence. And so the editor I was working with thought it'd be a great idea to ask him if he would write a foreword. And he did it at probably the busiest time in his life when his, you know, this huge album came out and he was touring. So I'm really thankful to him for taking the time to do that.
Well, that book that Tyler's foreword appears in this collection, Clay's Quilt, quickly became a hit. A lot of word of mouth driving that. It showed up on none other than the bestseller list of the New York Times. Do you recall that moment when you found out about that?
Well, nobody was more surprised than me, that's for sure. When I sold the book, I figured, you know, some people in my family and my community would read it, and maybe some people in Kentucky would read it. So when it became a word-of-mouth bestseller, it was very shocking to me, and it was life-changing. You know, I was able to quit my job as a rural mail carrier, where I worked for 7 years, and really wrote my first two novels on those mail routes. And I loved my customers on the mail route, but it was a really hard job, so I was so glad to be able to quit. And then I wrote full-time for a few years, but then I found that just kept me on the road too much. I wanted to be home more with my children, and so I became a teacher.
Well, the second book, A Parchment of Leaves, did come only 2 years later. Also was a national bestseller. It's set in the years between the Cherokee removal and World War I. And you mentioned that you got a lot of feedback on this one. What have you learned from those messages?
Well, it is the novel of mine that I get the most letters and emails and messages and such about. I think the lead character just, readers are endeared to her. And she goes through such a struggle in the book. And she's trying so hard to be the best person she can be. And I think people just relate to that, you know. And in that book, I never knew my great-grandmother. And she died about 20 years before I was born. And I was just trying to put together the little pieces of her life that I knew about and write a life story for her because she's a very mysterious figure in our family. And there's just something about that character that speaks to readers. And so I'm glad she does.
Parchment was soon followed by The Cole Tattoo. And you mentioned the family tree that appears in these books earlier. And if I understand correctly, it's this book that reveals the connection between Clay's quilt, A Parchment of Leaves, and the Cole tattoo. And I'm wondering, in writing Clay's quilt, did you then envision this connection, this connecting thread running through subsequent books, or did that idea come later after the completion of Clay's quilt?
No, it would have been so much smarter commercially for the books to be published in chronological order, but they're actually not, because Clay's Quilt is actually the last book chronologically, but it was the first book published. The reason they weren't published in order of the time period is because I had no idea they were connected until I started writing The Cole Tattoo, and I realized the two main characters in The Cole Tattoo are the granddaughters of the main character in A Parchment of Leaves and the mother and aunt in Clay's Quilt. So suddenly, in writing the third book, I realized they were connected. And so I think most people have read these books not in chronological order. They read Clay's Quilt first, which is set in about the year 2000, and then The Cole Tattoo's mostly set in the 50s. The Parchment of Leaves mostly set in the early 1900s. So you can read them out of order. You don't have to read all three of them, or you can read all three of them in order, and it's like one 900-page book, if you want to do it that way.
If you really wanted to get the full effect, would you recommend reading them in chronological order?
Yes. But I think that's a good idea, but absolutely not necessary.
Okay. Yeah. In the reissue of A Parchment of Leaves, there is an essay by novelist Amy Green, and she talks about how the book is a touchstone for her own writing. And I'm just wondering, how does it feel to have this sort of connection with a writer like Amy Green?
Well, I sort of laugh because it just makes me feel kind of old to hear, to hear writers or musicians say that these books were influences for them as young people, but the books have been out, almost 20 years now. The first one has. And so, it's just a great honor anytime that, anybody tells me a book of mine has spoken to them in some way. I mean, and especially if somebody tells me that it's changed them or influenced them, I just can't imagine a bigger honor. I mean, I think that's one thing about Appalachian literature is we all feed each other in that way. Each generation is really fed by the last generation. The work of Lee Smith was particularly influential on me, and I just tell everybody how much I appreciate Lee Smith's work. And so I think that I'm just thankful anybody has read the books, period, but it's especially nice when another writer who becomes a New York Times best-selling writer like Amy Green, a beautiful novelist, says that about my work.
Silas, I know that music plays a role in your work, and you highlight this connection between music and literature in your own essay in The Cole Tattoo. How does music influence your work?
I grew up in such a musical place and a musical household that it just makes sense to me for music to be a constant part of the day. It's one way that I get to know my characters. If I know what kind of music they love, then I know the characters. And so it is really important to me. The Cole Tattoo opens with a woman dancing to the song Maybelline. And once I knew that that was her song, I knew everything about her. I knew who she was. And so I just think it works on several levels for readers, too. It allows readers to hear the scene, it informs them about the characters, it gives them a time period hints, things like that. So I just think it's such an effective thing to do. When Clay's Quilt came out, it got a lot of attention because of its use of music. But I didn't do that thinking that it was anything new or, intentional on my part. It was just that was who I am. Music's just such a part of my everyday life.
I know that you've been looking at a film treatment of Southernmost. Do you envision screenplays based on any or all of the novels contained in this trilogy?
I got my fingers crossed on that film of Southernmost. There's some good people working on it. And Clay's Quilt actually sold twice to the movies. And, you know, it's just such a gamble. You never know what will happen with them. And so I try not to think too much about that. I mean, I think I love film, and that's the main reason I would love to see any of my books made into films. But at the same time, it's always a gamble when a book is turned into a film as well. So it could go either way. But I would be perfectly happy to see any of them on the big screen for sure.
I was going to say, I hope the day comes when we can all go buy a big tub of that great popcorn at the Kentucky Theater and settle back and watch them.
Me too. If any of my books ever become a movie, that would be one thing I would ask for. Is that I would want it shown at the Kentucky Theater because I love going there, and that would be great.
Kentucky author Silas House, a reissue of his novels Clay's Quilt, A Parchment of Leaves, and The Cold Tattoo, just published. And yes, you will find it on Amazon.com. Thank you, Silas.
Always a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
On next week's edition of Eastern Standard, those skeletons in the family closets.
I happened to mention this to a friend of mine who was a retired investigative reporter, and within hours, he had started turning up my grandfather's story, and it became more and more fascinating the more he revealed. And this was over a period of some years, finally. We just decided it was a story that just had to be captured, and finally decided that writing a novel was the way to do that.
Sally Showalter on her fact-based novel, Next Train Out. Lee Todd returns with his series on the connections between education and economy. How pandemic layoffs are inspiring thoughts of a change in direction.
I hear about it every day.
Serve Kentucky Executive Director Joe Bryngartner manages AmeriCorps Kentucky and the service jobs it offers.
Every single day I either get a call or I get an email or someone from my staff does. From somebody saying, you know what, I can't find work, or I've heard about this program, haven't known enough about it, what can I do?
And Carla Gover is back with her Kentucky Songcrafters series, her guest, Lexington musician Marcus Wilkerson, on his new release, That Day.
It's inspired by the Juneteenth, June 19th, when folks of African descent who were slaves were informed that they were free.
We'll have these stories and more next week on Eastern Standard here on WEKU. And that wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.